Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. As you drive along St. Helens Road in northwest Portland, to the west rise the West Hills and Forest Park. But to the east, you see a landscape diametrically opposed to the verdant scene across the highway. What's in those tank farms that go on and on, bordered by railroad tracks where you can see oil trains almost all the time now? That's the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, or the CEI Hub, where 90% of Oregon's liquid fossil fuel is stored, along with natural gas and a massive tank filled with liquid natural gas. And you may ask yourself, how did this all get here? Today we talk with John Washutinsky, the director of the Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, about how and why these hazardous tank farms have come between the Willamette River and Forest Park, the dangers they pose, and what you can do about it. John, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, just this past Saturday, I was hanging out at Zenith Energy, a demonstration where we all gathered at the corner of Kittredge and Yonge, which is right across the street from where they are building the great new Forest Park Information Center. And it was kind of ironic that there's Forest Park and all the ways it's being celebrated across Yonge. But where we were standing, you could start to get the fumes of what we were going to experience as we crossed over that bridge that crosses over the railroad tracks and to Zenith. And perhaps the biggest shock for me, worse than the odors I was smelling and the headache I was getting, was seeing how much infrastructure has been built at Zenith since the last time I was there, which was 3 years ago. And for people who don't know what Zenith Energy is, let's just start out by talking about that, because that's kind of the latest assault, I think, on this area that's known as the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. And the amazing array of fossil fuel facilities that reside there.
Yeah, Zenith is a really interesting company. It was originally a facility that was built to import heavy oil substances for asphalt production, shingle production for roofs and whatnot, but was bought by this company, Zenith, and has been repurposed as an oil export facility. So now they bring in oil from the tar sands or from the Bakken area and put it from the oil trains into tanks, store it temporarily, and then put it onto barges and ship down the Willamette River and out to export markets or to refineries along the West Coast. So essentially, it's a pipeline on rail wheels coming down from the middle of the continent here to the ocean export facilities at the port. And so, you know, it really poses a lot of danger from every step of the production process, from the extraction and the incredible environmental destruction that happens in the boreal forests of Canada or in the Bakken formation out in North Dakota. And then, of course, we've seen the consequences of transporting these fuels by rail in Mosier, Oregon, and in other places throughout the country and the North America. And then, of course, once it gets here to Portland, the dangers don't go away. We actually kind of transfer the danger to, you know, our own community from emissions, from transferring the fuels from the rail cars to the tanks, and then, of course, out through a pipe to waiting barges on the Willamette and the potential for spills, you know, along the way there, too. So it is a really strange facility, something that we've fought against throughout all of Cascadia successfully, but this one kind of snuck in.
Well, let's talk about how it got here, because I recall back at the end of 2016, the Portland City Council passed an ordinance banning any future fossil fuel infrastructure development. And I know that Zenith hasn't built any new tanks, though in some ways it might be better if they had new tanks than the ones that they're using, which I heard at the rally on Saturday were built in 1957 before there were any kind of seismic requirements for safety. But I was really struck by just how much of the rail infrastructure has been built. As what I remembered were grassy fields and actually the place where I parked my car in 2019. It's all built up now. And there's also this big wall and this barbed wire to keep those protesters out, I guess. But how did that happen? I thought we had this ban to prevent this kind of development from happening in the fossil fuel arena.
Yeah, Portland's been a real leader in terms of developing this fossil fuel infrastructure ban, which I think is a really important policy tool to help prevent more of these types of facilities from coming. And of course, that was put into place in the wake of the Pembina bid to create a propane export facility at the Port of Portland that, again, community rose up and stood against and was able to defeat. But, you know, sort of unbeknownst to us at the time, this company, Zenith, had obtained permits to build more stanchions or, you know, basically stations for unloading rail cars at this facility in Portland. So that gave them the go-ahead before this policy was in place to develop these new stanchions and increase the number. So I think it went from something like being able to unload 8 rail cars to 30 or 40 rail cars at a time. So it increased their capacity to, you know, kind of transport this huge volume of crude oil by rail.
Zenith didn't come to town until the end of 2017. So that's like a full year after this ordinance was passed. I know you're not with the city, yeah. You're with the county. But how did they get past it when Portland supposedly had this ordinance that would prevent this from happening?
Well, they bought a company that had secured permits. And so essentially they were able to buy one of the assets that this company sold to Zenith was the ability to build, you know, more infrastructure. And so they kind of got away with it.
I did some research when we first found out about Zenith, which was actually a while after, like over a year after they'd actually started this stealth operation.
Right.
And I found out that Zenith has been doing this around the country. They find places like where there's a vulnerability. And I guess in the case of the Portland ordinance, it was being still litigated because the Portland Business Alliance and some of the other fossil fuel industries had challenged the ordinance with the Land Use Board of Appeals. And even though the Land Use Board of Appeals upheld Portland's ordinance, there were some things that had to be tightened.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, Portland still hasn't tightened them. I mean, I don't think the ordinance has any teeth yet. Is that true?
It's continuing to be litigated, yeah. And the city just won again in court, which is amazing. And of course, the industry has appealed again. So, you know, this is likely to continue to play out, you know, this cycle of, you know, appeals for a little while to come. But eventually the ordinance will be put in place. Zenith kind of came in at an odd time and was able to, you know, sort of sneak in, like I said.
Well, one of the things that's kind of unnerving for a lot of us is when we learn about how the fossil fuel industry operates and that they're looking for these vulnerabilities. And
yeah.
Portland, in a way, I think, was kind of the poster child of how Portland's standing up to the fossil fuel industry. Well, we'll show them. We'll find this little dent in their armor where we can just pound it through and push this thing through. So why do you think it's really important that Portland is able to maintain the efficacy of the ordinance that it passed now 5.5 years ago and to push Zenith out?
One issue about Portland is, you know, we are at a critical place geographically. And so with the development of the tar sands and the Bakken Formation, there was no pipeline infrastructure to move that, you know, dangerous fossil fuel product to market. And so they've had to, I guess, get creative. And one of the ways they've done that, the fossil fuel industry has done that, is through rail shipments. And of course, when you look at moving rail from the middle of the country out to ocean export facilities, the gorge becomes the obvious route by which to move those materials. And that's kind of created this rush to try to build export facilities, you know, here in the Willamette Valley and then, you know, out into the Columbia River Gorge. And of course, Zenith has not been the only success story in that regard. Global Partners was a facility down in Clatskanie that was built, you know, with, you know, state subsidies to be a renewable fuel facility. It never was able to really operate in that way, but was bought up and then turned into a fuel export facility. So there's really been looking for these opportunities, I guess, to find ways of exporting their product, you know, using a combination of regulatory vulnerability, but also looking for the right geography, if you will, in order to get these products to market.
Well, that's why Eric DePlace, who was formerly with Sightline Institute, dubbed this region the Thin Green Line.
Right.
And when I'm having a hard time, which is like most everybody I know right now is having a really hard time with what's going on in the world, I try to remember about the victories. And I think if you go through a litany of all the fossil fuel projects that have been shut down in the last 10 years, and particularly in the last 2 years, it's something we can really feel good about. Looking at those past victories, how can we move forward to deal with such a gnarly problem as Zenith?
Well, I mean, I think that whether it's Zenith as a microcosm or really the issue of fossil fuel companies writ more broadly, what's we've seen as being successful here in the Northwest is communities rising up and saying no. So I think that combination of community pressure and policy innovation has been really successful in order to move the needle and prevent some of these projects, you know, which included, you know, not too long ago, you know, massive coal export facilities and, you know, really, really nasty old school technology. So I think, you know, that combined with a vision, a positive vision for the future that, you know, bases our economy on regeneration and renewable energy really is what is going to drive the transition.
Well, just thinking, after shutting down the possibility of some major coal export facilities being built both up in Washington and along the Columbia River, I think the next really big project that was stopped was the Tesoro Savage oil by rail terminal that was being proposed for Vancouver right across the river from here. And that was, was supposedly a done deal. All of these things were always done deals. And then the communities rose up. And to me, it was really amazing to watch Vancouver, Washington, that is, transform itself into maybe something that looks more like Vancouver, BC, in terms of the politics and the community building. So how do you see that we can take these challenges and really build community around fighting them?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really informative about the Vancouver, Washington example is that really the Tesoro Savage facility would have devastated their economic development plans, which was really built around creating more access to the Columbia River. And what a beautiful waterfront esplanade they've created, lots of office space and mixed use development, of course, housing as well. And it's really a picture, I think, a contrast between what we can have, which is, you know, thriving communities built around human needs and what the fossil fuel industry is trying to sell us, which is, you know, facilities that create a lot of danger, pollution to humans and to the ecosystem. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that the community voices that step up come from lots of different places, and I was really proud during the Tesoro Savage fight to be able to bring a resolution with Chair Kfouri to oppose fossil fuel exports, whether it's here in Multnomah County or facilities that would impact Multnomah County because the oil would transit through Multnomah County, or, you know, in the case of Vancouver, Washington, an accident in Vancouver, Washington would have, you know, severe impacts here in Portland and Oregon and vice versa.
And we'll get a little bit more into just how wonderful the county's become in the last few years, because it's really, it was very heartening to watch the county actually take stands even before the city of Portland did around all these issues. So I'm very happy for the current county commission, and I hope that it remains as strong in the, after the next election. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBRU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with John Washutinsky, the director of the Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, about how and why these hazardous tank farms that we see along the Columbia River and along the Willamette River in the North Reach have come between the Willamette River and Forest Park, the dangers they pose, and what we can do about it. So let's talk about not just Zenith, but this history that has allowed Zenith to be there. There's this thing called the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub, which is a term a lot of us only really became aware of a few years ago. But that array of tank farms has been around for close to 100 years now. Right. And I want to talk about the history that has created the tank farms and how that has informed the struggle that we're having now to stop future fossil fuel development.
Right. Zenith, of course, is one facility in this larger constellation of facilities that are in that area that we refer to as the Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. And I think all of us who live in the area have experienced the strange contrast of being on Highway 30, going to Forest Park, and, you know, on the one hand, you know, being immersed in this beautiful nature and, you know, streams and towering trees, and on the other, maybe smelling the emissions from the tank farm, or, you know, seeing the tank farms that creep out to the river, and really kind of being jarred by that contrast. The farm was developed really for two reasons. One is that the access to the river, right? So you can actually bring in materials or move materials via water and barges. And the other is the Olympic pipeline that comes down all the way from Anacortes up in Washington and flows, brings oil products all the way to Salem. And so the tank farm there becomes sort of the temporary storage facility for these products before they move out via barge or via truck to, you know, locations all around the state.
One of the little tidbits that we've learned is that 90% of all of Oregon's liquid fossil fuel is stored in those tank farms. But also, it seems like in the case of Zenith and some of the other multinational fossil fuel industries that are there, that we're actually just a pass-through. So
right.
Let's parse that and distinguish between what's staying here and what's going elsewhere.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the weird thing about Zenith is that, you know, Portland, for a long time, we've been getting fuels here for use in the state and in the region. What Zenith is doing is actually taking materials, crude materials, and exporting them. But for the materials that come here, really, you know, gas and diesel and, you know, obviously there's the LNG tank as well. What we're doing with the gas and diesel is, you know, powering, you know, bringing fuel to gas stations, essentially. So, you know, if you are down there, when you were down there probably this past weekend protesting the Zenith facility, you probably saw a bunch of these big tanker trucks coming in and out constantly. And those are, you know, heading out on I-5 or out on I-84. And, you know, going to all those various gas stations that we all utilize to power our cars. So that's really what the facility is all about.
I was just thinking about some of the odors that I smelled as we were walking across the bridge that goes over the railroad tracks. And there was that smell of rotting eggs. Mm. And I thought hydrogen sulfide. I don't know. I mean, you can't breathe very much hydrogen sulfide before you would collapse.
Right.
But I wondered how much is there. I thought it could also be sulfur dioxide, which is not quite as toxic, but which is still pretty bad. But I know that in the course of the 5 minutes that it took to walk across the bridge, and that seems where the concentration of those fumes are, I smelled this such an array of horrible things. And I wonder if you have any idea of what it is in there and where those odors are coming from.
Well, I mean, that's a big problem with air quality regulations in general, but for the CEI hub in particular, is we don't really have a great sense of what's going on there. At the county, the county commission has really fought over the past 5 years to help create a more robust air quality regulatory program in the state. But, it's catch-up mode after decades of, really lax regulation. So I don't think we do have a strong sense of what's happening in terms of air quality. Really, the permits there are, the air quality permits are sort of taking the company's word for it, you know, in terms of what the emissions are, using outdated formulas to sort of calculate what those emissions could be. And I think one really important thing that needs to happen is to, you know, for our environmental regulators, the Department of Environmental Quality, to investigate and have a good, robust monitoring program to determine, you know, what emissions are actually coming from those facilities. Are their permits adequate? Do they have the adequate safety measures in place? And, you know, this is a topic that folks in Linton have been organizing around, one of many topics. And you know, of course, the Linton community is right there on the front lines. And so they're smelling the stuff every day.
I would just like the DEQ regulators to go stand on that bridge for 10 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd be curious. Maybe I should figure out how to do this. I'd like to go out with them and see if they can identify each one of the separate smells.
Yeah, and the smell, you know, really we carry around this great, air quality monitoring device called our nose with us, and it doesn't capture all the potential pollutants, but smell certainly can be a strong indicator of problems.
And then there's the neurological sensors too, because I was surprised. I think of myself as being pretty hardy, and I've gone to many toxic sites and spent a lot of time at the Port of Tacoma, which I'm not sure smells as bad as the Port of Portland does. And I was surprised at the fact that I was getting a headache within about 2 minutes of being on the bridge. And I think these are indicators, which I know the people in Linton have been talking about for years and years.
Absolutely.
I wonder if it's nice for someone who lives in a part of Portland where the air quality is probably the best to have to, you know, subjugate myself to that and to understand what people who live close to the port and the harbor are experiencing. Maybe we should have a rallying of getting people just to go expose yourself to the Portland Harbor and see what people are talking about. And maybe that would create more of an uprising.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that the CI Hub is where it is in part based on the fact that the city of Portland, before it grew to include The Linton community kicked out fossil fuel companies because of the danger that the tanks posed to the city of Portland. The Portland fire chief actually died when a tank in Portland exploded, and the city council said...
Actually, that tank was right near where Kibu is. It was in what's now the Central Industrial District. Yeah, and it was down probably within 10 blocks of Kibu.
Yeah, and I think the sort of wisely the city leader said, boy, we shouldn't have this stuff close to, you know, our downtown area. But, you know, that put the community of Linton really on the front lines, and they're still there.
It's interesting that shortly after all the oil tanks and fossil fuel tanks were moved out to Linton, then Linton was annexed by the city of Portland, which actually allowed the city of Portland to run roughshod over the community in a way that it hadn't been able to when Linton was an independent city.
Hmm.
Because it seems to me that over the 100 years and more since Linton was annexed into Portland, that it's been treated exceptionally poorly. It's not treated as a part of the city that matters. It's treated as the part of the city that's where we dump all our waste. And that was true of St. John's, too. When I moved to Portland a number of years ago, Portland's garbage dump was in St. John's. And that's been closed since then. But I still think people in North and Northwest Portland, that part of Northwest Portland, feel like they live in the garbage dump for Portland.
Right. And I mean, running roughshod over the land, too, that area where the CEI hub is located was wetlands, essentially, you know, critical environmental habitat for fish and other animals that's been filled in over the years. So there's, you know, there's this legacy of running roughshod is you know, continues.
Let's talk a little bit about that landscape. One of the things that Sarah Taylor, who's one of the founders of the Braided River Campaign, which is really working hard to transform this area, she talks about Giles Lake. And I remember when I first moved to Portland, there were two signs that really confused me. One was signs for Giles Lake, and the other one was for Swan Island, because there was no island and there was no lake. Let's talk a little bit about the history of Giles Lake.
I'm not super familiar with Giles Lake specifically, but I am sort of familiar with the general history of the CEI hub, you know, in the sense that, you know, when you look at aerial photos of the hub over time, what you see is land kind of being created out of, you know, being filled in, essentially being created, as opposed to having been there, you know, as part of the original geological landscape.
Well, one of the things that Sarah points out is when you go up to where Montgomery Ward was, because it's now Montgomery Park, and you look down, you actually can see what was Giles Lake. You see the lake basin.
Hmm.
And it's interesting that the contours, as you go down the old St. Helens Road that leads you to Yonne and to the Highway 30, that you're actually following the upper edge of the lake. It wasn't a lake like Lake Tahoe. It was a much more shallow lake, and it was part of the whole wetland system of the Willamette River, which is also a very shallow river. And that there was a while, like, when they did the Lewis and Clark Exposition back at the beginning of the 20th century, that they sort of beautified the lake, and I'm not sure what they did to make it a little less marshy, and that was kind of the way it was for the exposition, and then shortly after that it was bought by industry and became the wasteland that it is today.
Right, when you see those pictures from the Lewis and Clark exposition, you're like, what part of Portland is that? You know, I want to go visit that part of Portland.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings actually about whether you want to do that to wetlands or you want to leave them the way they were before.
Sure.
Because it was such an incredibly rich area for all the people, and particularly the tribal people that lived there for millennia before the rest of us came here.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really important that we take some time to kind of learn about what that area was like, because that maybe gives us more of an idea of what it is that we want to fight for. But I'm curious about your take on how the mentality that allowed the city fathers of Portland to just do what they did to this incredible, what was once a very incredible verdant landscape.
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to the idea that, you know, the landscape is something that we can take in order to, you know, pursue our narrow goals and really sort of a mindset that doesn't view, you know, our home, and I'm not speaking in terms of a house, but really the whole ecoregion in which we live as being vital to our own health and to the health of our family and to the health of our community more broadly. And so I think it was really just viewed as a way to, you know, pursue these narrow set of goals around making money and being able to have this sort of short-term focus on what's going to be good for the people maybe who were stood to profit from that development.
And those people, a lot of them have streets named after them, like Pettigrove and Cooch and Lovejoy.
Right.
Yeah, so you get a street named after yourself after you destroy the landscape. But the people that were displaced, let's talk a little bit about who was displaced from that landscape.
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, this is a landscape that was, you know, rich with wildlife and plants that were important to Native American communities, the Multnomah people that were, of course, encountered by the Lewis and Clark expedition that we mentioned briefly before. And so, you know, this was a verdant landscape of, you know, seasonally with various, you know, fish like salmon coming up the river, and then also Wapato harvests and you know, just sort of the right of the river and the landscape and the ecosystem to exist for its own sake.
Well, I wanted to get a sense of whose bright idea it was to store 90% of Oregon's fossil fuel, liquid fossil fuel, in one place. And we'll talk in a little bit about how dangerous that place is, but just even if it weren't a liquefaction zone on top of a seismic fault, why would you want to do that? And are there any other places around the country or around the world where there's such a concentration of really hazardous materials for that serve a much broader area than just the people within, let's say, a 10-15 mile radius of the facility?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. If there's sort of like analogous you know, facilities around the country or around the world. I suspect it's probably the case. I mean, the fact is that there was probably, you know, the combination of access to the river and the access to a pipeline probably combined to sort of present a certain logic for why that area was chosen to be the main repository for fossil fuels.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBU Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with John Vostrutinsky, the director of the Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, about how and why the hazardous tank farms that belong to Portland's critical energy infrastructure hub have come between the Willamette River and Forest Park, the dangers they pose, and what we can do about it. Let's talk about the dangers. Now, it seems like it's common sense for anybody who knows the slightest thing about fossil fuel is a lot of it's really flammable and dangerous and toxic. And so what are the dangers of having so much of that concentrated in a slightly questionable area? Let's first of all talk about the ground that all those tanks are built on.
Well, yeah, like we were talking about, the ground was filled in. I mean, it was used to be wetland areas, and then it became filled in with, you know, dirt, you know, leveled out, and you know, to create this hub area. And what, you know, was, I guess, not known at the time is that, you know, our region is very seismically active, and that includes, of course, the Cascadia subduction zone fault line that's out in the ocean or along the continental shelf, that's, you know, due to you know, release of a very large seismic event at some point in the, you know, we're not sure when, but it's going to come, and it's going to be big. And then there's also fault lines that run directly underneath the CEI hub, kind of, if you imagine the ridge that Forest Park sits on, kind of, you know, parallel to that ridge. So you know, I've heard it kind of referred to as really the last worst place that you would ever imagine putting this much flammable, toxic liquid.
Well, I understand. I've heard people say, in fact, it was a press conference that the county and the city and the organization that wrote a study that we'll talk about in a moment about the dangers of the CEI hub. And they talk about how Portland is the only place that has these tanks placed on in a liquefaction zone. And actually, that was incorrect, because I spent a lot of time at the Port of Tacoma over the last few years. And I think that there's probably many places like this, because the Port of Tacoma is, again, it's tidelands. It's a lot of fill, actually. They completely transformed rivers into these weird, hardened channels and things like that. The only difference that I can think about the dangers of the Port of Tacoma and the Port of Portland is, believe it or not, there's more tank farms in the Port of Portland on the CEI hub than there is throughout the Port of Tacoma. And that's saying a lot, because the Port of Tacoma is a much vaster area than Portland's port. So beside the fact that this is a common practice to put these things in really stupid places, I wonder what is being done to address that now that we know the dangers.
Well, I mean, I think that we've developed a robust body of knowledge around what the dangers are. I mean, you look at the maps that are created by the state around, you know, what the amount of shaking and the amount of land damage, deformation that will happen after a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. And you kind of zoom in on the CEI hub and you really see that being that, you know, kind of the epicenter of damage that will occur after a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. So two phenomena that will happen is, you know, one is this liquefaction, which is basically where soil begins to act more like a liquid than a solid as the water table kind of gets pushed up. And the other is a phenomenon called lateral spreading. So essentially the soil will move towards the river during an earthquake. And both of those things are very bad for big cylindrical tanks full of liquid. And so we anticipate that most of those tanks will fail.
So what happens when they fail?
Well, you know, we can look at when this has happened in other places. So, you know, notably, the PSU has done some research around what's happened in Alaska or Japan when there's been subduction zone earthquakes that have impacted this kind of tank infrastructure. And, you know, essentially they crumple, the pipes that are connected to them rip away, the fuel evacuates. Some of them have floating lids to produce fewer, emissions of volatile compounds. Those lids, as the tank evacuates, have metal on metal spark points. So some of the stuff can ignite. There's, you know, of course, high voltage cables going across the river in that area. That's another ignition point. So there's lots of potential for fire. There's lots of potential for explosion. And then there's obviously lots of potential for spill of the, you know, these toxic materials both into the water and onto the land.
So it's sort of like a combination of the Deepwater Horizon disaster and Fukushima.
It's going to be really bad. You know, the volume of fuel that is about equivalent with what was we presumed to be have been released during the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, except that it's in the heart of a major American city and it will occur over the course of a few minutes. So it's going to be very bad. And of course, I think the context, the other context here is that, you know, with a subduction zone earthquake occurring, there's going to be disaster everywhere, right? I mean, you know, whether it's just, you know, buildings collapsing, bridges collapsing, it's going to be very difficult to respond, if not impossible to respond to what's happening at the CEI hub.
Yeah, I think the only bridge that would withstand an earthquake that size is the Sophie Island Bridge. But certainly the St. John's Bridge is going to come down.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
So what is being done about that? I mean, this is something where I think people, particularly people in Lytton, have been yelling about this for years. And maybe a little more recently, other people around Portland. It seems like now it's becoming almost common knowledge. And so let's actually first of all talk about this report that the county and the city commissioned to look at the impacts of the kind of disasters that would happen from an earthquake. And then I want to talk about what's left out of that report, which I find equally or even more frightening. But let's start with that, and then we can go into how we actually respond.
Sure. The, really a few years ago, prompted by this feeling that there was a lot of information about what we already knew to be the risks of the CEI hub, but precious little action on it, the city of Portland, really Commissioner Hardesty and Multnomah County, of course, with the leadership of the chair, but also Commissioner Meyer and Commissioner Jayapal, said that let's really get a handle on what the danger is. What are the economic impacts of this? What are the ecological impacts of this kind of infrastructure and the potential for it to be destroyed during an earthquake? And then let's figure out, you know, what is on the books now and what the gaps are between what's on the books and what actually needs to happen. So that was really the genesis of the report. We hired Eco Northwest to do the report for us. And over the course of about a year, they looked at, you know, how much material is stored there, where is it stored, what are the conditions of the tanks that it's stored in, and what's likely to spill into the river, what's likely to spill onto land, and what are we going to, you know, what are the, you know, existing kind of federal statutes around protecting all that. And really the picture that the report paints is quite dire, and we've talked about that already a little bit. So what
let's talk about some of the specifics. I mean, things like how much of the Columbia River would be contaminated, or how big the fire in Forest Park might be.
A little bit of this is depends on the seasonality of it, right? So if there's a incident in the winter, and it's, you know, we're having a Oregon wet winter, it would be good maybe because it's the Forest Park might not burn, but it would be bad because the water table's higher and there'll be more shaking in the hub. If it happens in the summer, the water table's lower, but of course the forest can be dry and that might, you know, spark, you know, the you know, devastating secondary impact of it, which would be a fire in Forest Park and all the, you know, life and property that would put at risk. So, you know, that's certainly a big kind of dimension of what can happen.
I know that there's been some movement in addressing this. Senator Dembro proposed a bill which was passed in the last Oregon legislative session. Let's talk about what's in that bill and how much that really moves us towards a place of dealing seriously with this complete disaster that's about to happen.
Well, I mean, the great thing with our report was that the release of the report happened right around the time of the beginning of the last legislative session, and Senator Dembro was able to capitalize on that along with other representatives, and really use it to finally get some movement on this issue. Because, like you've alluded to, that we've known about the risks of the CEI hub for a long time. There was that great documentary from OPB called Unprepared. That talked about this issue. And, you know, for the first time ever, there was an actual push by the state to address it. And it was Senate Bill 1567.
What does it contain?
It requires that the 10 facilities at the CEI hub do seismic risk assessments, and then it requires them to submit those assessments to the Department of Environmental Quality. The Department of Environmental Quality will then sort of determine whether or not those assessments are accurate and complete, and then it will require the retrofitting of those tanks. Unfortunately for us, of course, the timeline for that stuff is kind of protracted, and so it's going to take us. It's going to be years and years, and there's going to be lots of rulemaking, and of course, opportunities for shenanigans from industry. To try to, you know, delay all this as much as possible.
Well, actually, I remember at the press conference that the county gave when the report was released, and I asked the question, I think I asked it of you, actually, about what do we do in the meantime? Because I think they're not going to start working on it till July, next month.
Yeah. Which,
but it takes 2 years before they have a report. And so the question is, what happens in the next 2 years if we get even not the big earthquake, but a smaller earthquake along the Highway 30, which would be devastating to the CEI hub?
Yeah, there's this risk is there all the time. And I think part of that is just, you know, part of the work that the City of Portland Emergency Management Division does and the Linton Community Net team does is really just thinking about, you know, what are the response capabilities to really protect people in case that does happen, you know, at any moment, like it could. But I think the kind of policy solutions here that we've talked about as a Multnomah County have really focused on, is there a way to help push these facilities towards more responsible behavior through financial surety mechanisms, basically having the insurance necessary to pay for the damages that will occur when the big one or even, like you said, a smaller earthquake happen.
Well, one of the things that I fear is watching how the fossil fuel industry has dragged their feet and opposed every environmental law and every climate change law possible, and particularly the Portland Business Alliance, and that's one reason why Portland's infrastructure ban on new fossil fuel infrastructure isn't in effect yet is all because of litigation that was triggered by the Portland Business Alliance. And it feels to me like trying to get gun control. You know, you have these, I guess I was reading there were another whole bunch of mass killings over this past weekend. It's insane the level of violence in this country, and yet we can't agree, or we can't get a few very powerful voices to agree that we have to stop putting so many guns into our culture. And I feel like it's the same issue with having this fossil fuel infrastructure in such a hazardous place is like having major explosives, like major firearms that are about to blow up the entire city.
Yeah, I think that like these are systemic issues, right? So these are not issues that play out sort of at an individual household level. They're systemic issues. And what needs to happen in order to address them is these, you know, high level systemic changes. And they only happen when we stand up together as a community to demand that change.
So how do we do that? I feel like, on the one hand, I feel like the county commission has been listening to the climate movement in Portland for quite a while, and has been in the forefront of proclamations and ordinances and anything you can do, even just letters of support to the Portland City Council to deny the land use compatibility statement to Zenith. So there's that. And then there's the city of Portland, which feels like the city council is a little bit on the dysfunctional side lately and is having a hard time really moving forward, with the exception of a couple city council members, one who you mentioned earlier. So I wonder, how do we get the county to have more pressure on the city, even though we're talking about areas where the city's really in control or the state is in control? How can the county use whatever leverage it has?
Well, I think that the county commission has really been trying to use all the leverage that they have in order to address these issues, and really bringing a health-focused approach to you know, the impacts that the fossil fuel industry is having in our community, right? I mean, whether it was the heat dome last summer or this ever-present danger of, you know, the Cascadia or other kind of seismic event at the CEI hub, we're really trying to push on all fronts in order to get action to reach our goal, which is to not have fossil fuels as part of our community anymore. And that has to happen here in Portland, but of course, globally as well.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with John Voschutinsky, who's the director of the Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, about how we deal with the dangers threatening us from Portland's critical energy infrastructure hub. And how do we reclaim that land, maybe, to become something a little bit more in service to humanity and to nature? So let's talk about your vision. And I interviewed you a few weeks ago, you talked about a vision that you have for getting beyond having this kind of monstrosity of tank farms aligning the Willamette River. Well, you said something then about needing to be creative and rethinking what we're going to have. So how do we start this rethinking process?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the vision that, you know, Chair Kifori put forward and the board has adopted is really a future in which we don't have fossil fuels, because we obviously need to stop using fossil fuels in order to address, you know, the climate crisis. But also to, you know, improve local air quality from emissions from cars and trucks, which is, you know, the number one source of pollution in our community, both climate and air pollution. And of course, this issue of the CEI hub. And so as we start to think about a future without fossil fuels, I think it allows us to think more creatively about what the CEI hub can transform into, or maybe transform back into. You know, for one, the amount of employment that actually occurs in those in those many acres that are occupied by the hub is relatively low. You know, we're talking about hundreds of jobs, whereas, you know, in other parts of the city, it's thousands of jobs per an acre. So even if we continue to use the land for, you know, industrial purposes, I think there's, you know, lots of opportunities to, you know, build the renewable economy in that area, with much more employment than is currently there.
Well, Sarah Taylor, who I mentioned earlier, who's with the Braided River Campaign, she did a slideshow she showed us last week of the unused industrial land that's along the north reach of the Willamette River. Because one of the things that industry has complained over the years is there's not sufficient industrial land in Portland. And so we have to use more natural space or more golf courses or whatever to create more industrial land. So she showed all these areas where there's a lot of industrial land that's right now fields. Some of it was very beautiful nature. They make beautiful salmon habitat. But the one slide she had that really jumped out to me, because at first I was thinking, what is this doing here? But it was a shot of Nossa Familia's facility that's along the North Reach in the Portland Harbor. And this is a wonderful local coffee roastery. And they are providing probably quite a number of jobs relative to their size. And she put it in actually as a model of what could be there.
Right.
And that would serve. So I thought it's kind of interesting, as we think of coffee as being one of Portland's iconic characteristics. And so what else do you see besides Nossa Familia that could be set up along the current area where the CEI hub is that would serve the values that we claim to profess here in Portland?
Well, I mean, just going back to that Vancouver, Washington example, when we had a hearing at the Board of County Commissioners about our opposition to that project, the board's opposition to that project, some longshoremen came in and talked about how they're shipping windmill blades up the river in order to help build wind facilities in eastern Washington and eastern Oregon. And it really kind of goes to show you that you don't really need to move all the way away from having a manufacturing base or having an industrial base to reach this future that we all want to. It could be, any number of uses that support the renewable energy economy of the future. And hopefully also some restoration of the natural ecological function of that area.
Well, let's talk a bit about what that needs. I mean, we've talked in the show a lot with Bob Salinger, who's been championing the need for restoring some salmon habitat along the river. And one of the things he says is that whatever we do to pollute and degrade and destroy the Willamette River, the fish and the birds still use it as a necessary corridor, migration corridor. So how do you see incorporating more naturalization or renaturalization of that reach of the river that's right now all concrete and asphalt and weird stuff and fossil fuels and who knows what else in the ground?
Well, one important thing to note is that, we're still dealing with the industrial legacy of the 20th century and cleaning that up with the Portland Superfund cleanup effort. And now, but there's this looming threat, right, of this new contamination from the CEI hub if an earthquake were to hit. So getting rid of that threat in and of itself is going to be a huge benefit to the natural environment, because we take away that recontamination risk. But beyond that, I think that, there's streams and rivers that are, underground now in pipes as opposed to, flowing naturally and, providing habitat and, all those benefits. So I think daylighting those back up, opening those back up, creating access to the river for people and for animals and plants are all wonderful opportunities that, as we're seeing in Vancouver, Washington, present the possibility to really spur economic development here.
Did Vancouver, Washington daylight any streams that flow through their waterfront?
I'm not sure, but I'm just talking about providing that access to the riverfront and being able to invite people there. Because, every time we spend a dollar on gas or diesel fuel, it leaves our community. But when we invest in our community in terms of renewable resources or natural resources, it creates economic activity that stays right here in Portland and benefits us locally.
Well, one of my fantasies for many years has been daylighting Balch Creek, which flows through Forest Park. And when you enter Forest Park from the Upshur Street entrance, you actually come right where Balch Creek is culverted. And I've talked to several people who've been active in daylighting streams, and I'd say, well, isn't there a way to daylight Balch Creek? It's a rather major source. It's a major water source. I think it used to be Portland's drinking water back before Bull Run was. But I've been told, no, it's really too hard. There's all these businesses, and there's all this pollution, and there's no way to do it. But I wonder if we can start thinking and imagining, if we were to really work towards daylighting Balch Creek, how to do that, how to override all those commercial interests, all those financial interests, all those environmental challenges, and what that would mean if that part of Forest Park was connected back to the Willamette River.
Well, at one time, people imagined this beautiful, verdant landscape as being a way that they could make money, and by bulldozing it and filling it in, and creating what we see today. And I think that now, part of our project is to imagine a better future, imagine a future that sustains our community, for the next century and beyond. And so that's our project, I guess.
Well, you mentioned last time we talked about the important role that creativity plays in Portland's self-image. So how do we see creativity maybe replacing fossil fuels as the next economic force, let's say, in Portland?
Yeah, I mean, already creativity has created the opportunity to move beyond fossil fuels, right? It's not a matter of, developing a new technology that doesn't exist yet in order to replace the energy that we get currently from fossil fuels. Those technologies exist, and it's really a matter of scaling them up. But the other important thing to remember is that the renewable resources that we all have access to today is our creativity. It's a boundless source of possibility.
Well, John, I'm really happy that you are at the county in the Office of Sustainability, which is a relatively new office, I'm assuming, isn't it?
We were formed in 2010.
Yeah, well, relatively new still. But it's good to see that our county is thinking in terms of at least dealing with sustainability as opposed to whatever it was dealing with 100 years ago. How do you see moving forward?
Well, as I mentioned, that we're still working on developing this policy around the financial surety mechanism, what we've kind of referred to as the security deposit. We're all familiar with that concept. So that's something we're continuing to work on, and of course going to be tracking and helping our partners at DEQ implement 1567. So we're going to keep plugging along.
Well, John, it's great having you on Locus Focus. I hope we can talk again pretty soon and see how things are going, particularly after the next administration of the county starts in January of 2023.
Well, you're quite welcome, and thank you for having me.
I've been talking with John Vashutinsky, the director of Multnomah County Office of Sustainability, and you've been listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all of us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And again, I'll say today, I'm again in the station 2 weeks in a row, and I understand that we are going to have a slow, soft reopening of people coming live to the station, which will hopefully help us suppress the pandemic. You can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Columbia Riverkeeper's new incoming director, Lauren Goldberg. We'll go out with music by the Talking Heads. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Get your COVID shots. Remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask. And I want to thank Ray Bodwell, who's been my engineer when I'm here live. And without Ray, the show would not go on.
Let the days go by, let the water yourself, this is not my beautiful house. You may tell yourself, this is not my beautiful wife. Say to yourself, by God, what have I done? Let it end.